This is Nigel Leader Williams, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee on the 20th of September 2013. Nigel Leader Williams, Part 2.
We were talking about the impact the reindeers had upon the flora of South Georgia. What about creatures? Were they damaging other wildlife?
The reindeer were basically taking out the tussock grass, and ground nesting birds live in the tussock grass. So there was concern about the petrel nests on South Georgia being potentially damaged by the indirect effects of reindeer grazing. The other issue potentially is that the reindeer have brought in some different parasites. For example, we found some stomach worms on the reindeer on South Georgia that the Norwegians at that stage still hadn't found in their own animals from which the stocks must have originated. But these worms will presumably be having some interaction with the nematodes on the island. So that could be an important area of study for people still to do. It's not one I know if Bill Block and his colleagues have looked at actually doing. So at that level there are concerns about the way the reindeer may interact with the local fauna.
There were other studies elsewhere in the world of reindeer impact as well, weren't there? And you were able to compare, or have since been able to compare, your work with that.
Well, one of the most interesting studies, and indeed one of the great conservation classic stories, is the introduction of reindeer to St. Matthew Island in the Aleutians. Reindeer were put onto this island. They depended on lichens for their winter food, and in one very cold year the lichens got under ice sheets and the reindeer couldn't dig them. There was a population crash from 6,000 animals down to 41. Amongst those, only one was a male, and that was among the animals that were shot to see what was going on with the remaining population, and that population obviously died down. Now, what happened on South Georgia was that the scale of the eruption was not as high as on St. Matthew, but the high density of tussock grass and the fact they depended on tussock grass during the winter meant that they have not crashed like the St. Matthew animals, because they're not dependent on lichens.
You, before you left South Georgia at the end of your 2.5 years, you got your fencing equipment out.
We put in fences as part of the reindeer programme. Simon Kiteley went down with me in 1973. And Ron Lewis Smith and Dave Wharton helped think the program through, but we put in some long-term exclosure sites in 1973. Unfortunately, one lot on the beach got flattened by elephant seals, because that was their territory, but the rest have actually survived, and they've shown very interesting recovery of the vegetation when reindeer are excluded from grazing it. So the greater burnet that I mentioned already as being one of the species that was massively affected by the reindeer, that has come back in its old swards when it's left from grazing. And equally, the lawn grass, the poa annua that I said earlier had actually invaded with the help of the reindeer grazing, without the grazing, was going back. So trends were there, suggesting that the vegetation could return to something like its old self if there were not the grazing pressures of the reindeer there. The critical one that I'm not sure about whether it will return is whether the very extensive moss banks will allow grass to come up from within or not. But you know, that's a matter of waiting and seeing. And this has not been too dissimilar a situation to other southern islands where other introduced species, for example, like sheep on on Campbell Island have been culled off. People don't get so worried about killing sheep because we're used to killing sheep, but people get a bit more concerned about killing reindeer off. But in those sites, the vegetation has come back and recovered to a remarkable extent. So the assumption is that now that we've got that evidence, that following the current cull that they're doing of reindeer, there will be good recovery of the vegetation.
So then you came back and wrote your reports. And were you kind of expecting there to be a reindeer cull shortly after your research was made known?
Not particularly. I always thought that a big issue would be the cost of doing it and whether it's a priority. But at that stage, I'd been living in Africa for 5 years, and I was looking at the dilemmas that people have got on whether you pay for conservation or whether you pay for other things that your population needs. So for people living on the Falklands, is the eradication of reindeer really that important an issue compared with improving the hospital or the runways? And you know, I just said, well, if it happens, it happens, and if it doesn't happen, it won't happen. And well, I probably expected it, on balance, not to happen.
But it is happening now, almost 40 years later. And what's a timeline? What's the story of the procrastination of that decision?
I haven't been as involved as you might expect in that. My direct involvement with Bass and the reindeer were in three periods. Period one was 73 to 76 when I did the field work, and I haven't been back to South Georgia since. 76 to 1980 is when I wrote up the bulk of the scientific papers and my PhD thesis from the work I did. I then went to Zambia and heard about South Georgia's invasion when some friends from Malawi came down and said, have you heard South Georgia's being invaded, one Easter? And I was sitting in the middle of Africa getting on with work on rhinos and elephants, not particularly thinking about anything much to do with South Georgia. So when I finished that work, I was asked if I would come and put together the monograph from all the other papers and get it written up, because it would be a really interesting contribution to South Georgia's general well-being. So I came back into Bass and spent 6 months there writing the work up, and writing the work into a monograph, and also writing a new paper that looked at management options for the reindeer. And then I just left it at that.
So you were writing recommendations at that later stage?
I left a set of options. I didn't go for a recommendation. I didn't feel it was my job to write a recommendation. Thereafter, in I think 2000, Bass, with David Wharton probably playing a major role in all of this, started to begin to write management plans that laid out more concrete actions. And why it took from 2000, the first management plan, until now to cull the reindeer, I have no idea why. I think from what I've heard, there has been an element of fortuity in this, because they really worked out that they wanted to try and kill the rats off, but on the area where there were reindeer and rats, they couldn't kill the rats off if the reindeer were still there. So the reindeer cull has almost been a fortunate accident.
Sorry, is that because the poison put down for the rats would affect
The reindeer would eat the poison for the rats, and then there'd be a serious welfare problem. So the way to get round it in the areas where there were reindeer was to kill the reindeer off first and then do the rats after the reindeer were culled.
And the rats were seen as a far worse problem?
The rats, in the paper that I wrote on the management options, I said, you know, really the reindeer are a small problem compared with the rats. The rats are really serious because they're widespread and all over the island, and they have got a major demonstrable effect on things like the pipits and the ducks and so on and so forth. And that's the case all in many other countries. It is the introduced rodents as a real problem, but it's the New Zealanders who've set up techniques that are gradually becoming more successful at eradicating bigger and bigger areas of rodents. But up to now, it's been the case that it's much easier to kill off the large mammals through, you know, shooting and similar programs. It's very much harder to do anything with the rodents. But now the technology's come in to do rodents, and South Georgia will be the world's largest rodent extermination experiment when it's all completed.
Do you have any feelings about the reindeer cull? Are you, I mean, talk about human emotion about it all.
I tried to write a neutral paper, that one I've referred to, that came out in 1989 on the management options. I think it's a finely tuned balance of value judgment as to which way you go for. I recognise that for the island's ecosystems, killing the reindeer off is a good thing. But equally, they were a fairly spectacular part of the island's fauna, and tourists liked them, so they had other advantages other ways. But I think the thing that's gradually brought me round to thinking that the reindeer should be eradicated is the fact that glaciers are retreating around South Georgia, and some glaciers that once kept the reindeer bounded in particular areas have gone back to such an extent that there's much freer movement of the reindeer around. And when the big sea entering glaciers go the same way, then the reindeer would have freedom to roam over the whole island. So a major difference between the rats and the reindeer, just to make it clear, the rats were basically on most of the shore, most of the snow-free areas between glaciers. Reindeer were only in three of them, and there's a small population of mice that has been in one area where the rats aren't. So it's the rats that are the real problem in terms of how widespread impacts are. And the reindeer could follow much more easily as the glaciers melted. So because you can't do anything about glacier melt and you can do something about the reindeer, I feel at the end of it's a pity to see a PhD project get shot up. And, you know, here's this book, and is Cambridge University Press going to be able to sell any more of it when there are no more reindeer?
It's going to be history, isn't it?
It's going to be history. But on balance, I think I've gone in the way of accepting that the reindeer should go.
There's a story about the one of the delays was the fact that the governor's wife on South Georgia didn't want to see these nice furry creatures being shot.
Well, one of the issues here that is a typical problem for wildlife conservation is how conservation requirements and actions mesh with people's concern for individual animals. So let's just mention the case, for example, of the eradication of hedgehogs off islands off the Scottish coast. There is a belief that the hedgehogs have had a major impact on the ground nesting birds. Conservation authorities have made perfectly responsible decisions that the hedgehogs should go. But then there's groups of people who are interested in things like St. Tiggywinkles and in rescuing those hedgehogs and getting them back. There are people that go around fur farms saying these animals shouldn't be shut up, let's let them go. Well, letting mink go into southern England, well, what do they think they're doing? And the reindeer are a not dissimilar problem or potential issue. They are fluffy, they are charismatic, they're a very beautiful addition to the island. And I can see that people who don't like animals being culled wouldn't like the reindeer to be shot off the island.
Well, they're also a man-made cock-up, aren't they?
They are a man-made cock-up, but people do tend to forget that. Mm. The grey squirrel and the red squirrel are a man-made cock-up, but many people think the grey squirrel should be eradicated. Other people feel that it's a great shame that squirrels are shot and they object to it. So this is where animal welfare intersects with conservation.
Is this a dilemma that stalked the rest of your professional life?
Not this particular one, but other dilemmas have stalked my field work. I've been very lucky to work on different systems where other threats have been a problem to conservation. So the famous conservation biologist Jared Diamond said that there was an evil quartet of factors that were really causing threats to species. One was introduced species, and I've obviously been able to research that in the South Georgia situation. Then there's overhunting, and I've been fortunate enough to study rhinos and elephants who are being heavily poached. The third one is chains of causality, where the loss of one species affects the others that are dependent upon it. And I've been very fortunate to look at that in a study of rhinos and the way that they disperse sausage fruits and sausage trees around about. So, you know, that was another issue that I've been able to look at. And habitat loss. And that's a real problem as human populations expand and you've got balances to reach between natural land and human land. And I've been fortunate enough to work on that in Tanzania at a policy level. So I've had a good exposure to all four of the evil quartet and the way that it influences conservation in different situations. And that's been a great privilege. But I haven't had to get too involved in issues that relate to culling overabundant or human cocked up populations. But I have written quite a lot about different forms of hunting, which don't make me one of the most popular conservationists.
How do you mean?
Well, a lot of people don't feel that animals should be conserved, for example, by allowing a limited number of them to be trophy hunted and then to provide revenue to look after their conservation.
But what you're suggesting is a pragmatic approach.
I hope that I'm fairly pragmatic, which I put down to my veterinary training. But there are people who do not like people going to Africa and bagging a set of trophy animals. But the wildlife economies of many countries depend on that happening. So again, it's back to the animal welfare, single animal issue. Are you going to promote this as a good form of pragmatic conservation, or are you going to say nothing should be shot? So we're back to this same dilemma, animal welfare and conservation.
Do you feel that your veterinary training, therefore, if you like, kind of removed the emotion from your thinking about animals in this way?
So I think you're probably very wise to pick that up. Vets are told they can't get involved with their patients, just like doctors can't. So you have to deal with somebody coming to you as a vet to ask for your animal to be put down. They're in floods of tears, but you've got to get on and do the job professionally. But I can also remember that when I've had to take my own animals to be put down, I'm in floods of tears. So yes, I think you've got to separate these two things out.
So it trained you to a clinical approach?
I think that is probably...
So going back to an earlier point I made about your feelings about the reindeer that are now being culled, to a certain extent, they are your reindeer, because you know them better than anybody else. So do you not feel the same emotion as when you took your dog to the vets?
I knew them better a long time ago, and you know it's long enough ago for it not to be an issue. I think I probably would have been quite upset if somebody had said one year after I'd finished the study, well, we're going to shoot them all. Mm. But it's happened long enough ago that it's not so much of an issue. And as conservation comes on and makes itself increasingly sophisticated, we've got to think about ecosystem type arguments. and improving the overall ecosystem of South Georgia must be a good goal. But it's a pity that reindeer are caught in the crossfire.
So, in principle then, given those kind of dilemmas, and you, as you mentioned, you have studied them elsewhere in different ways across the planet, is the ideal solution, generally speaking, to try and return the environment back to the state it was in before man did silly things with it?
Many conservationists would like to see that sort of thing happen, returns to wilderness areas and promoting pristine environments. But there are others who I think would very clearly say you can't turn the clock backwards, mm-hmm. or you can only turn it backwards so far. And I think that there's a large element of that. We haven't got space on this planet for increasing massively pristine areas and keeping people out, because the world's human population is expanding to such an extent that it's not going to be possible. It's going to be much more productive to look at ways that wildlife and people can live together. But in the case of South Georgia, I think you go back to the fact that there was never anybody there anyway. So it would be better returning as far as it can under, with a little bit of help, you know, from the cull, but then using its natural agencies to recover back to something like it was.
So by the same token, and although you didn't have much to do with dogs on South Georgia, the whole concept of removing dogs from the Antarctic is a step in the right direction.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah. The thing I did do, which is probably one of the most significant conservation actions I've done, is spay the cats on South Georgia. So when I went down in 1973, there were some cats still around in the whaling station. The base cat was, dear old mum, was very much treasured by everybody. She's nice and friendly, but she did get her reproductive bits cut out, making use of a trained vet on the base at that time.
So your Liverpool schools were not completely lost then? Do you know if your research was consulted prior to this recent culling of deer?
I would think so, but I haven't. I've never really thought to ask anybody.
Hmm. Okay.
You'd need to ask people like Martin Collins how much use it was.
Okay. There are one or two other things I want to ask you about being in the Antarctic anyway. And I was intrigued by this note that you seem to get the blame for the Argentinian invasion of South Georgia. Were you to blame?
I don't think so. But it made a nice story at the time.
What's the story?
I hope I get most of it right. A very clever independent journalist called Paul Pickering had looked into what Bass was doing at the time. And after I'd left and was writing up on in Cambridge, Bass was getting unwanted attention from certain quarters who didn't think it was a worthwhile thing for the government to be funding, particularly when they were seeing the ship getting loaded up with so much as was called polar beer. The amount of supplies going onto the ships made people think and were able to sell stories that we were just basically fueling drunken expeditions. So he wrote his story and he got his money up at that point. But then when the Falkland war happened and South Georgia was invaded, it's back to this time when I was in Zambia and friends came down to visit us from Easter, over Easter, and said, did you know South Georgia had been invaded? And I hadn't got a clue. I hadn't listened to radio for months.
How do you feel about that?
I turned the radio straight on, was really surprised, and tried to follow, obviously, as much as I could of what went on to the BBC World Service at the time. But this man had also picked up the fact that I'd written a paper called Abnormal Testes in Reindeer as part of the research. There's a thing called cryptorchidism that does affect a number of children where people's testicles are up in their abdomen and they have got to get pulled down. I found a small sample of these cryptorchid reindeer amongst the sample that were shot. And I'd included them in the write-up of the much larger picture of how the reproductive physiology of male reindeer worked in a single paper, but the editor had told me that this doesn't sit well with that and you should separate them out and make two papers. So this paper, Abnormal Testes in Reindeer, appeared in the Journal of Reproduction and Fertility. And the same Paul Pickering picked up from a list of Bass publications the fact that Bass had produced a paper on abnormal testes in reindeer. And he said, isn't it ridiculous that we're spending all this taxpayers' money to pay for a paper like this? Well, what he hadn't realised is that this was a totally unimportant part of a much larger picture, but being a clever journalist, he picked it up and he twisted it in its own way. And then when South Georgia got invaded, he wrote a story that he managed to get in the Times. He moved up from the polar bear stories in the Daily Mail into a story that got written up, as I say, in the Times. And he tried to make the argument that the Argentines had heard that the British were leaving South Georgia because a mad scientist had written a paper to say that people's testes were turning abnormal on South Georgia, and that therefore they were all going and leaving the island behind. So now the Argentinians could come in take over the island because all the British were leaving because they were worried about their reproductive parts. That story got into the Times and, you know, created a laugh. But I think the side of all of that that is still really not known is the extent to which there was a genuine contract to get scrap metal taken off South Georgia. Because when I went over to Leith Whaling Station, as you know, for our reindeer work, there were 16 phosphor bronze propellers sitting on the shoreline and presumably exceedingly valuable. Salvesons knew that those propellers were there and they would have been worth a lot of money. So, you know, to what extent any of that was a genuine issue or not, I don't know. At the same time, I was sitting in Zambia not particularly worrying about it.
So the scrap metal merchants were legitimate?
Well, I think there's a question mark still left as to whether there was a genuine contract to do something about getting those phosphor bronze propellers taken off South Georgia and put somewhere.
What they shouldn't have done, of course, was to raise the Argentinian flag, according to the popular press at the time.
Well, that's a different issue. But, of course, the way that you claim a colony is to raise a flag, set up a postal system and set up a judicial system. And I guess the Argentinians would argue that, you know, we stuck our flag up on the Falklands inappropriately. But I'm not a political historian, and that's not my field of enterprise.
Were you able to correct the Times in any way?
It was really unfortunate. I sat down and immediately wrote a letter to the editor. I drafted it out. But I got a reply from them several weeks later. So the trouble was that it had taken all the time to get the story there. Mm. If you want to get a response back to a letter in the Times, you've got to do it immediately. And, you know, those were in the days when we had a radio and know anything else. I posted my response out and got a nice response back saying, sorry, time's passed too much for people to link a story that was 3 or 4 weeks ago with your response.
Did you have any tricky moments in South Georgia? Any moments where you were worried about your survival?
Not that worried, but I do have memories of getting caught in a whiteout coming back from one of our outlying huts to the main hut on the Bath Peninsula, and feeling I was quite glad I got home when I got back. It was very white and very blowy.
Were you high up or on the coastline? Where were you?
Well, I think I probably didn't quite know where I was. But we were starting to go from the coastline up over the ridge between the two huts. But I think my instinct, I must have made that walk so many times that I kind of knew where I was subliminally.
And your tent was blown away.
Yes, the first night we actually spent out in the field during the first bit of reindeer operations we did. We got dumped by the Bransfield in the field. There were a lot of field parties on South Georgia at that stage, and the numbers of tents were relatively few. So we got given what proved to be an older tent. And the first night, a real hoolie blew off the glacier and completely shredded the tent. And we were trying, you know, just to rescue bits of stuff. And the ship called back with another tent the next day. And that was the thing that we were always told, was how expensive ship time was, and we had to avoid as much as possible taking extra ship time to do anything. So that was an example where it happened, but I didn't ask for the tent I was given. I was given a tent, and it wasn't good enough.
How did you survive the night with no tent at all?
Well, the sleeping bags were all okay, so you just sort of... The poles were still there. It just gradually, you know, fluttered itself...
To bits. Yeah. And you had an interesting experience crossing Harker Glacier at one point.
Yes, I'm not a mountaineer at all. I've not had mountaineering training. And a group of us went out on this marvellous hanging glacier just to the west side of Dartmouth Point and did one of the first crossings of it. I was in good hands with very good mountaineers, but I found it quite hairy. I like to go to the top of mountains to look at views, and I like to walk up, but I'm not a climber.
But you didn't fear for your life?
No, I didn't. Not with them, no.
You talked about how the second winter was different from the first winter in that you, because of the cycles, the natural cycles of the seasons, no two winters are the same. I wonder whether your first and second winter were different in any other way.
Yes, I think I knew what I was doing at that point.
Second winter, you mean?
Yes, yeah. Yes. I mean, we'd had the experience of doing the first one. The issues of transport around the island to do field work in winter were better known. And I think I had a more understanding base commander in the second winter who realised we need to get out and get on with the work. In the first year, there was concern that South Georgia, we were trying transport to the field in rubber boats. That was the way that it was determined we'd get back and forward. And on the first bit of winter field work, I was left very frustrated having to pack my kit up every day for 3 weeks while it was thought to be unsafe to go over to the field site. And I wasn't best pleased and best happy about it. But we kind of knew what we were doing there, and we could operate much more efficiently and get on and do our work. But then I think there are also some different characters on base, and you know, they all make a difference. We all united around, and one of my other strong memories of South Georgia and my particular time there compared with what people must be able to do now, which is take down heaps of videos and have stuff to watch. In my time, we got given 5 films to watch for the whole winter. And they obviously had a very long hire period because they had to get picked up in the UK summer, put on the ship. They then spent 6 months with us on the base, and then they went home again the next year. So it was a very long hire and quite an expensive item for Bass to pay for. I can't remember what 3 of the films were, because we watched them once and they were so bad we just put them back in the cupboard. The second best film was Cliff Richard in Summer Holiday. Now imagine how bad the films were if you think that Cliff Richard on Summer Holiday is a good film. And then the one that I do...
Were you singing along?
We didn't put that one on, but I'm just coming to singing along, because the best film was a film of a coach trip of Americans around Europe. And the film was called If It's Tuesday, It Must Be Belgium. And yes, we knew that absolutely perfectly. Sing along to the whole thing. And that provided great bonding exercises, usually led by Scobie, who we've talked about before in connection with the rats. But it was a happy winter, that second one, with a very good base commander and lots of chance to get on and get the work done.
There was an outbreak of Morris dancing at some point.
Yes, one of the characters in the second year was a man called Tim Fogg, who was a biological assistant, and he was a great Irish whistle player, Morris dancer and all the rest of it. So yes, we had Morris dancing sets down in one of the houses on South Georgia that Tim ran, and it's very interesting to see Tim appear quite regularly on the television in films where he's now seems to be an expert either going down caves or climbing up trees for wildlife photographers. So yeah, he was one of the people who was on base and around.
How did you adjust to the concert to Morris dancing?
I'm not very good at it, but it was fun.
Are you taking it seriously?
Yes, I took it seriously, but I was never very good.
I imagine you took the football matches quite seriously, being a Copite.
I usually, sadly, missed the football matches that were regularly held when a Russian ship came and tied up at the jetty. But I did participate in one of them. My normal position would have been a goalkeeper, and I was the goalie for the for the game. And I do remember a very thick vodka got brought out, one of these vodkas that's like mercury going up a glass, fairly intense, and particularly spicy gherkins. And I'm afraid I didn't do very well the rest of the evening after having a drink.
Did the UK team tend to beat the Russians? Or?
No, the Russians often used to... the Russians, I think, used to beat us a bit more often, as I understand it. I didn't go to that many of them, as I said, but I think we got fairly soundly beaten, the one I remember playing in.
I seem to remember from a previous interview that the Russians actually came equipped with kit. The CCP shirt, red shirts.
Yes. Oh, yeah. No, they were on a diplomatic mission.
What, to avenge the World Cup of 1966? Or?
No, I think probably, just trying to not get run in and get their water. They wanted to come in and collect water, and they were clearly starting to begin to fish quite seriously. And I guess at some point the South Georgia police would need to start to think about dealing with them a bit more effectively.
Did the UK team have kit as well?
I don't think we did.
Did health and safety ever raise its ugly head at all?
It wasn't quite such a big thing, and it didn't have to be quite so formalised. But, you know, people were clearly, you know, as with anybody going down on Bass, in amongst the FIDs, there were a lot of very experienced people at Mountains and so on and so forth, which is why they were, you know, why they were chosen to go. They took their safety very seriously, but I have no recall or memory of having to write out a health and safety form, as in my current job since we have to do in exhaustive detail for something that just appears completely silly.
Mm. The meat you were therefore collecting from the reindeer you shot that wasn't destined to go to Cambridge, whilst I was wrong about you selling it, I think it's being sold now to help subsidise the cull. In your day, you just cooked it on the spot. I think you became quite good at cooking reindeer meat.
Yes, let's just correct one or two things. I never took any meat back to Cambridge. I only took the biological specimens we needed to work on subsequently. But because an animal was being killed, wherever possible, my assistant and I always put meat in our rucksack and brought it back to a point where it could be collected and hopefully consumed by base. But there was, you know, more reindeer meat in outlying areas than we could bring back, because after all, you're meant to be doing a science project and not carrying meat around where it was awkward. But we did want to bring back as much as possible. And yes, I became an expert cook of reindeer fillet steak. It is the most delicious meat. What in fact we did was buy a large jar of Uruguayan red wine, and the reindeer meat got marinated in the wine. And if we were in the whaling station, it got cooked on the coal fire, so a toasted fillet or stewed. And then on base, my contribution to the midwinter meals, or whenever I had to do my share of cooking, was always a reindeer Wellington, made up with tin peaches as the sweet bit that you put into a Wellington.
When was the last time you cooked reindeer?
1976. I've cooked lots of red deer and Chinese water deer, but reindeer per se, yes. 1976. But I think your point about the retrieval of the meat from the cull, yes, the cull is going ahead. It's being done by Norwegians. And I think as part of the justification, just like as I've mentioned in my own case, you're killing something, therefore you feel you want to make use of it. That same ethos clearly flows through Norwegians, who've got very strong feelings for reindeer, and I believe they have made efforts to bring back and retrieve meat from the South Georgia cull. But it must have been an incredibly expensive enterprise.
Hmm. Bringing it back to the tropics.
Well, they'll have to have a freezer ship, and yeah. Yes, I mean, even, you know, paying for a ship to come down from Norway, sit around while they put the meat on it and load it up. So, you know, how long is the ship sitting offshore South Georgia for, waiting to fill itself up with meat, and then the voyage back? It must be very expensive. But this is one of the things that has actually got lost in the cull, is that there is a little, you know, we wrote up the paper on options for culling, that the South Georgia population of reindeer offered a control for reindeer in the north, which had been subject to the Chernobyl explosion. So the South Georgia reindeer should be the only reindeer that are not radioactive. One of the consequences of eating lichens is that radioactivity goes into lichens, and radioactivity then goes into the things that eats the lichen. So they were finding traces of radioactivity from Chernobyl in northern reindeer for quite a long time. So the southern reindeer won't have been exposed to any radioactivity. So they're a control, but that'll now get lost.
So are the Norwegians doing the cull because they put the animals there in the first place. Is that a moral responsibility that they should go in and do the job?
I'm afraid I can't answer that. That's a question you'd need to...
Was it purely a contract?
That's exactly right. But clearly they'll have very passionate feelings about the way the cull is done, how they were engaged in it, and who brought who. Whether the Norwegians said to the South Georgia authorities, we suggest there's a cull and we'd like to come and help you with it, or whether it was the South Georgia authorities saying, it is our responsibility to cull these, how can we best get that done? Let's approach from Norwegians. I suspect it's the latter, but no, I've been worrying about Africa at that point.
How important, further south, midwinter, is a very important event in the FID calendar. Was that the case on South Georgia?
Absolutely, yes. The cook, with help from the rest of us, basically put out enough food and drink for a party to last for 4 days or so. And yes, it was just amazing.
What do you remember? What visual images are popping into your head right now?
Ski races. I've even got a photograph of our midwinter thing there. But no, beautiful. The South Georgia dining room, the Shackleton House dining room, had got the most beautiful, long, polished wooden table in it, completely laden with food, people in kilts. We'd usually had to do something stupid, and my contribution that year to being stupid was, as you can see, but your listeners can't, I'm bearded, but I took off all my beard apart from a Tex moustache. So I remember being Tex moustached, other people with shaved heads and so on. And then for the next 2 or 3 days, again, watching if it's Tuesday, it must be Belgian for the umpteenth time, having ski races and you know, going for walks and so on. But it was a very important part of the whole the year.
I've got some questions suggested by David Walton, who you'll know well, if I may. And some of these we haven't. We may have touched on one or two of these, others we haven't. To what extent did your experiences on South Georgia affect your ideas about the kind of career you wanted later on?
Well, I was... I've described already the fact that I trained as a vet and I thought I'd look for something different, you know, for a while, but I fully expected to be a vet again. But having written up the reindeer work and started to give talks on it and show it around, I sort of got the feeling, well, perhaps there's also something more in this than just pack up now. Mm. And if you want to call yourself a bona fide large animal biologist, well, you've got to go and work in Africa with all its Pleistocene fauna. And, of course, I'd got my role model in Dick Laws, who'd done all his classic African work and his Antarctic work. So I started to look for projects that might be suitable to take me to Africa. And the stage at that particular time, rhinos and elephants were coming under renewed interest and pressure from poachers. And there was concern about what that was going to do to those particular populations. And when attention is on something, it tends to be easier to get money. Now, I'd been completely spoiled in Bass, because once you've got a job in Bass, you're paid a salary, the equipment's provided, somebody else has had to fight you know, to get the programme accepted up at political levels. You don't have to do any of that. So I hadn't done any of that sort of thing, but I had to set up a project somewhere to get funding for it and to try and get it approved. So it was a completely different experience. And money tends to follow where there are problems, so rhinos seemed a good place to start. And after all, the rhino isn't too far distant from a horse. So, you know, let's go and give it a go. And I got money to support the work, but fortunately no money to support a salary. And I managed to put together a whole set of sponsorship from Land Rover, from Dunlop, from bunches of very well-known British firms who said, let's support this mad Englishman while he goes and studies rhino in the back end of Zambia. So I got on, got that going, and I'd started out with a plan that what I would look at would be the ecology of rhinoceroses. They were a browsing animal and very little was known about the way that they interacted and competed. So it was all intended as serious theoretical work. But it very quickly became apparent that poaching was much worse than anticipated. And if I was to do anything that was of any use, and here's my practical side coming out again, we needed to understand better how the poachers worked and how the offtake rates happened. And I was fortunate in being able to turn to the literature on whaling. So I got my South Georgia books out again, and we put together a project that looked at poachers as if they were whaling ships trying to catch whales, which were rhinos. And that's become a classic study of the amount of effort you need to put in to try and conserve rhinos and elephants in areas in Africa. And while the population of rhinos and elephants in the rhinos in Zambia went right down to pretty close to zero, I take comfort from the fact that that policy started to get followed in other countries and has been the reason why rhino numbers have started to recover. Though, of course, there is now another massive wave of poaching coming in. So the reindeer led to the rhinos in a kind of haphazard fashion. And I'd then done the rhino work and wrote that up. Said, but this is some really important policy work, but it's just standing here as research. What else can I do next? And I was then asked to apply for a job to write policy for the Tanzania government as to how wildlife conservation in that country should work. And that was a real challenge. I was put in at undersecretary level in the ministry, and I had to watch everything go on in a poor country in Africa in the way it does, yet with magnificent wildlife resources. And that was very challenging. And then it came time that I had to get the kids educated. So I started to look for jobs in UK, and I was very fortunate to be offered a professorship at the University of Kent at the Durrell Institute of Conservation and Ecology, which has a very strong mission to build capacity amongst African nationals in their conservation efforts. And I'm delighted with what we did there over the 15 years that I was there. About 500 postgraduates from 80 countries went through the Institute, and they're all getting on and doing great things. And just by coincidence, this morning I've had a text from an Ethiopian student who did his master's with me, who then went to America to go and do his PhD in natural resource management. And he's now going back to South Sudan to try and implement community conservation in an area that once had the most magnificent migration of lechwe that is now thought not to still be around. And that's where I get a real buzz now. All of these guys who have been through getting their degrees and supervision and so on, now getting on and doing really important jobs in conservation.
You're not the first scientist to talk about this, but it seems like there's almost an inevitable portal that a biologist in particular goes through, where he goes from being a research scientist through to the dark side of being a politician. David Walton did that, Dick Laws did that, you've done that. Is it an easy passage, or is there a lot of heart-wrenching, mind-adjusting stuff that goes on inside as you start to grasp the political agenda?
You've got to take it in and think very hard about it, and there aren't many places where you can get taught how to do it. And that is, in fact, my next and, I presume, last career step, because I've gone back to Cambridge quite recently, 4 years ago, to set up a special programme in conservation leadership, where we're actually trying to get people to understand some of the things that they need to do exactly what you've just been describing. Many conservationists are people with biological training, as you've highlighted, but you're not going to change much by putting a biological agenda down on the table. Things will only happen and change if you bring the people you need to bring along with you. So in essence, conservation is a social science rather than a biological one, but the irony is that most of the people are biologically trained. And in our new degree in conservation leadership at Cambridge, we're getting these mid-career professionals in and trying to take them through issues that relate to the business of trying to lead change in conservation.
Are there sacrifices you have to make? Do you miss the benchwork, the fieldwork?
I very much miss the benchwork, but you have to do it through the students you work with, the people who are going to go on and go back home again. Increasingly, you do get chances to help write the papers from the research with them, but I guess it's also inevitable that you know, as you get older, you're not able to do the fieldwork to quite the same extent as well anyway, and you've got family responsibilities and university or organisational responsibilities. So I guess there's almost an assumption you'll cut down on the amount of fieldwork. But I do feel very envious when I have had somebody and we've planned their work and they're going to head off. At the moment, I'm just looking at a student who's going to go off to Annapurna and Everest to look at human-animal conflicts with snow leopards. And I haven't told him how jealous I am yet, but inevitably I am.
Can I ask you a bit more about the Africa to Kent move? Paraphrasing David's questions, was it an offer you couldn't refuse? Had you got fed up with Africa?
No, it was... It was a mixture of several things. First of all, we had to make a decision with two children where they'd be educated. Mm. So the options were to leave them to continue to work in somewhere like Tanzania and have the boys in international schools, which end up taking baccalaureate. The other would have been to have us stayed and sent them back to boarding public school. So the point of stability becomes not home, but the public school. And that, I guess, was rather like I did, and as it so happened, my wife did. And the third was to go back to England and try and get a job without having any real leads. So we ended up deciding that the latter was the best way to go. My wife ended up getting a job first, and then I was very nicely offered a job in the Institute of Zoology in London. But then very quickly I was offered the chair in Kent.
Did you apply or were you headhunted?
I was asked to apply, so it was a mixture. I didn't know the job was on. I didn't really particularly know much about what it entailed. So I sent off a blind application and was fortunate enough to get it.
Do you think the fact that you've been out of the UK university system for so long weighed in your favour or against you?
It could have weighed very much against me, but I'd been fortunate in a couple of respects. If I'd applied for the job at Kent, having been overseas and not having had any research papers against my name I would never have got the job. But I had kept up writing a few research papers when I was doing the work in Tanzania, and they were being published and could go straight into the research assessment exercise. If you don't know about it, it's probably not worth getting to find out about it, but UK universities have to go through every 4 years a public assessment of their contribution to research, because that's what they're meant to do. If I hadn't have been able to have contributed to DICE's research, I wouldn't have got the job. But because I'd kept enough research going, I was able to contribute, and that's what made, you know, got me into the job. That said, this was a very sensible institute, because in fact two of our professors, myself and a colleague, neither of us had had an academic job previously. And that was the thing that was interesting. We were thought to bring practice to the task, and we got our jobs because of that.
Just remind what DICE stands for.
The Durrell Institute of Conservation and Ecology.
Were you able to shape it as you wished whilst you were there? Or were there things that were left undone?
What I think I did there was get the germ of an idea and build it up. It had had an inspirational founder who said what we want to do here is entirely unusual, but he'd retired from ill health and I had to take the job over. I had to change very little with the actual ethos, I just had to make it work. And that was not particularly easy because getting it to work entailed making sure it was focused on overseas students and not on too many British ones. Conservation problems are mostly overseas, and that's where the capacity gap is. Where do you find funds to do something like this that is non-traditional? And how can you actually keep it rolling in amongst the traditional activities of a university, which normally require that you do undergraduate teaching and research of a theoretical and important nature? So we were in the middle trying to work at postgraduate, work on postgraduates and work with postgraduates, but at the same time do applied work.
And now you're back at the University of Cambridge, Director Conservation Leadership position there. And again, one of David's questions is, what is there still to be done before you step down?
Before I step down, I would like to see a large number of senior conservationists in important countries for conservation having been through my hands.
You've had a very international life, and I just wonder how highly those 2.5 years on South Georgia rate in your life.
They were obviously the start of it, weren't they?
They shaped your career.
Yes. I mean, I think, first of all, you've got to go back in my case to Dick Laws's influence. Having him as a PhD supervisor, even though by the time I had to come to write my PhD up, he was director and I wasn't able to see him that often. But you know, just knowing that his quality was watching what you were doing was really important. And getting a set of work out there that has proved to be good and still well respected obviously made a very wonderful start. And being able to base one's life around field work was also very important. So it was the fundamental sort of baseline. But I think my parents wondered, well, when is all this going to stop? So I think it was between Zambia and Tanzania when my mother said to me, well, dear, you seem to be having a very long gap year. She hadn't, as I think I told you earlier, not wanted me to do a gap year between school and university when I was only 17 and thought you could do that sort of thing afterwards. But it was between, you know, she did say that thing slightly, when are you going to settle down and be sensible?
Get a proper job.
Get a proper job. Mm. But that only, in fact, happened when I got the Kent job. So Bass was a proper job. The Rhino work, I was just, you know, floating around a completely free agent. The Tanzania work was funded by USAID, an international donor, through two conservation organisations. But I think I only realised I had a career when I joined Kent. You know, that I only recognised I'd done something serious at that particular point.
Do you think of yourself as being a FID? I mentioned this very, very beginning of our interview. I wasn't quite sure whether you were a FID or not.
Well, everybody who goes down with Bass and spends time in the field on South Georgia is a FID.
Do you feel like one?
I think back to FIDs a lot, but I guess if I explore your question a bit more, I've probably never been to a FID reunion or whatever, but I'm not a, I don't go to my school open day, or I don't go to those things because there's enough to do today without worrying about looking back. So yes, I get my Bass newsletter, and I've read that there's a reunion in Alnwick this year and thought, oh, wouldn't that be nice, but I'm afraid I haven't done anything about it.
You missed a treat.
I'm sure.
It's been great fun. Thank you, Nigel.
Thank you.